All right, our second case for this morning is Renard against Ameriprise Financial Services. And we will hear first from Mr. Gerbers.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. Renard, appreciate my game. My name once again is Terry Gerbers. I represent the appellant, Paul Renard. Renard appreciates the court's policy of limiting review of arbitration awards. However, whether this court applies the Federal Arbitration Act or the Wisconsin Arbitration Act, this policy must take exception to other policies, specifically making sure that arbitrators do not exceed their authority and enforce the party's contract, and to ensure that arbitration awards are not procured by fraud.
Now, I have to confess, I am baffled by your argument that there's anything wrong with applying the Federal Arbitration Act here, because to begin with, the Federal Arbitration Act applies to contracts in interstate commerce of a wide variety of kinds, certainly including this kind. Secondly, the parties actually refer to the federal law, and federal law isn't like some deciding whether the law of Wisconsin or Minnesota or New York or Hawaii or anything else is going to apply. Federal law is there, and I just don't know how you can say, well, we've decided to opt out. I thought we resolved this, 130 some odd years ago. So I just don't see how you have any argument.
Your Honor, you may be correct. I believe that Hall City, compared with the Generac case, kind of left open as to whether or not there are other options other than the Federal Arbitration Act. But I believe it's a red herring in this issue, in this particular case.
Well, what do you mean it's a red herring? It's your argument. You're the one arguing for the application of the Wisconsin Arbitration Act rather than the Federal Arbitration Act. And like the Chief Judge, I thought the doctrine of nullification was dead after the Civil War.
And the court may be correct in that regard. I think
I'm quite sure as a general matter we are correct, is it?
Yes.
But the problem then is, if you will agree that the Federal Arbitration Act applies, we've been very clear, and I really think the Supreme Court has been quite clear in recent years, that deciding that the arbitrators manifestly disregarded the law is a very narrow undertaking indeed, and these arbitrators seem to have had presented to them virtually every issue you'd like to talk about, and whether you like the way they've resolved it or not is actually not the issue before us.
Your Honor, I don't believe that that is the issue that is before us. I believe that the issue that is before this court is very similar to that in the Edstrom case, and that's, did they enforce the party's contract as a court
has read? What possible reason is there to think that they didn't?
Because there's no reference to the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law whatsoever in this particular case.
Didn't write an opinion.
So is it your position that when arbitrators don't write an opinion, we have to assume that they violated the law?
No,
it wouldn't be just state law. It would be all sorts of law, federal law, the contract. Whenever they don't write an opinion, they don't refer to the federal law, they don't refer to state law, they don't refer to the contract. And, of course, they're not free to violate any of these. You seem to want a presumption of violation.
No, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. We're not asking for a presumption of violation. In this particular case, there
what
was...
What would be different in not referring to state law and, say, not referring to the contract?
I don't know if there is a distinction in this particular case.
All right, so case. You would say, if we have to assume they violated state law, then we have to assume they violated the contract. We have to assume they violated the securities law of 1933. And the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, and all the FINRA rules, we would have to assume they violated all of those things.
That is premised on the notion that the Fair Dealership Law wouldn't apply either simultaneously with the securities law, or whether or not the Fair Dealership Law trumped the federal securities law by the parties.
A rational arbitrator, and this is, an issue that was put before them, could say, insofar as the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Law gives this 60-day period of cure and extensions of time, that the policy under federal law of making sure that the financial markets are operated appropriately supersedes those things. And if somebody like Ameriprise thinks they need to get rid of a person pronto, they can do that. You don't just say, okay, we'll let you keep selling inappropriate instruments. And again, that's their view. But and I'm just saying it. I have trouble understanding why a rational arbitrator couldn't reconcile the two laws that way, especially because the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Act doesn't say anything about arbitration. It doesn't say anything about which tribunal has to apply.
No, it does not. But I think what is important in this particular case is that Ameriprise came to the arbitration, acknowledged that these notices were not provided. The law is clear that
they said
notices,
they didn't have to because there are the securities laws and FINRA is entitled to apply them.
Well, that's why I believe in this particular case that the arbitrators did exceed their authority. I think it was at least
because
in
it's
part,
impossible for any rational person to think that to this degree there's federal preemption.
I think so. I mean, it was not rational to believe there was no case law suggested other than fraudulent case law that was provided.
Well, that's
to the
not
court.
Fraudulent. Moody. First of all, when counsel referred to the Moody case, he says, you know, it's a very pertinent case, and then I'm quoting, he says it's been preempted by this federal law, and then he adds, and it's a different issue, but it's saying that the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Act was absolutely preempted by federal law. And he calls to everybody's attention the fact that it's the Petroleum Marketing Practices Act, which happens to be a federal statute. He acknowledges, he's sort of, this is on the fly, he's giving argument, but he says it's a different issue. There's nothing whatsoever fraudulent about that.
Well,
half the briefs I've read would be fraudulent on that theory if I think counsel has stretched the meaning of a case further than I think it can go.
Well, I think in this particular case, that's exactly what counsel did, Your Honor.
Yeah, and I'm saying that's often a matter of opinion.
Well, my fear is that at some point in time, do we lose the ability to effectively present argument to a tribunal of arbitrators?
You do lose the ability to get a second look at it. That's precisely what Hall Street was saying. When people are in a system where arbitration is provided by contract, you're buying a one-shot deal. And there are some companies that prefer in different lines of business. I'm not talking about FINRA because that's the securities business, but some people don't choose arbitration because they like the idea of a couple of bites at the apple. But that's not what happens in securities matters.
Well, the concern is, Your Honor, is that if we are to accept the fact that these representations can be made to a tribunal panel, which everyone will acknowledge is not as experienced or as trained as a panel that's sitting
before me
today.
They may be more experienced, actually.
Well, in some cases, they may have sufficient experience, but is it a practice to push that to the point that you are misrepresenting the law to
there
a tribunal?
There were no misrepresentations. This is normal advocacy that occurs in courts every day. Reasoning by analogy, right? They were saying, here's a case that shows that the Wisconsin Fair Dealership law is preempted, and so there's a general, you know, preemption argument here.
That's not the way
that's
that it was.
Just reasoning by analogy.
Well, that's not the way it was presented as reasoning by analogy.
It is, actually. That's what the lawyer says. He says, and it's a different issue. And, I mean, it's not a paragraph, I understand that, but you don't have to be wordy to get the point across.
And you don't have to specifically identify to either a court or a panel of arbitrators that, you know, right now I'm reasoning by analogy.
Oh, I understand.
Everybody knows the rules.
Raise your little flag.
I understand that, but I think that in this particular case, it went beyond that. And the problem that I see is that it's going to become a practice.
You just didn't anticipate it.
Well, that's true. I did not anticipate it.
That is hardly a basis for an accusation of fraud against your opponent.
Well, when the entire case is formed as one saying that we had good cause to remove him, and then remove him from his franchise, to take his franchise, and even... There's nothing that I've seen, any case law whatsoever, that would suggest that the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law notices are not required to be given, even if there was a violation of the Federal Securities Act. And that's the concern
that
I have.
Well, so this exact case may not have come up, but counsel did point to some other cases where state laws that were otherwise laws of general applicability were preempted. And actually, Moody was about the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. It just happened to be a different federal law. Wisconsin, like any other state, is not entitled to pre-announce that it's not going to allow any of its laws to be preempted. That's inside out.
But this court has recognized Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law, the strong public policy
of course
from
it
the
does,
legislature.
But it, so does the federal security law.
But the federal securities law does not necessarily preempt it, just as in the...
But there can be particular instances. Federal securities law is probably completely uninterested in a lot of aspects of Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. But this was a financial services advisor. It's in the financial services industry, and so you're going to get some overlap. And in overlap, the federal law wins.
Do you have a concrete argument? We're in the world of the Securities Act of 1934, Securities Exchange Act. And Section 28A of the 34 Act tells us which state laws are preempted and which are not. I didn't see an argument in your brief based on the language of Section 28A. Are you making such an argument?
No, I'm not, Your Honor, but I believe that those...
Well...
but there's nothing that prohibits those two laws from coexisting, just like they did in the Lucarelli case in New York. They said that both these laws can coexist. What is...
And maybe they sometimes can, but maybe they sometimes can't. That's the issue. We have to assume the arbitrators heard all of these arguments. That's my problem, getting back to the scope of the very narrow scope of our ability to supervise arbitration proceedings. I don't see what went wrong.
Well, I think it's just going over that edge in this particular case to an arbitration panel, knowing that there's probably a narrow review getting to this court. And okay. I think, similar to the Edstrom case, that this court has to recognize when those issues are present so that fraud is not used as an incentive to move forward. And I understand the court doesn't believe it was fraudulent. The fact that it never came up until closing argument, never in the pleadings, never in the case.
Well, look, there were exchanges on cross-examination. Did you did you say that these were authorized when they weren't authorized? I mean, the guy admits, he responds correct when he's asked if he lied on the forms regarding the solicitation of these ETFs, and he says correct when he's asked, did you break the rules? That strikes me as a predicate.
Well, and those should be taken in context when Mr. Renard was doing that at the time. He was not aware that they were necessarily improper as long as he was being asked by certain clients as to exactly what options were there and that he didn't believe that he was directly soliciting. So that's the issue. But that's not really the issue before us. The issue is whether or not those notices are required, even when it's a Federal Securities Act matter.
Okay.
I see that I'm
into my
rebuttal
time. If you want to save
a minute
for rebuttal, you should do so now.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Stipich.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Ryan Stipich from the Reinhart Law Firm, representing Amer Price Financial. As your honor's questioning exhibited previously, the district court here properly viewed its role and the federal judiciary's role in relation to a motion to vacate an arbitration award. That role is not an error-correcting role. It's not to review the arbitrator's decision for factual or legal error, or even clear error, or even gross error. And it's not the role of the courts to treat arbitration panels as junior varsity trial courts, as this court has stated in the precedent.
Did you actually raise, in the course of the arbitration proceedings, the argument that you had terminated Mr. Renard when you did because you thought he was violating federal securities regulations or laws?
Or yes,
we did.
Did that
really just come up in the closing arguments?
Well, it certainly came up in the cross-examination of Mr. Renard's expert.
So you were quite specific that you were alleging a federal securities either regulation or law violation.
Yeah, I think that was crystal clear in the questioning in the quotation that we have in our brief at I believe page 32, where counsel asks Mr. Renard's expert on the WFDL, what are the obligations where there's violations of the securities law is going on. And he says words to the effect of, you have to give the opportunity to cure unless it's going to put Ameriprise in a position of violating those laws.
Yeah, it's pretty vague. Unless the doing so would be in violation of federal statute. So, I mean, there are a lot of federal statutes, actually, securities laws being among them. And then they go back and try to rehabilitate. But I take your point that it's a statement that Mr. Norman made. But is that the only time that there's at least an allusion to federal securities laws?
Prior to closing arguments?
Prior to closing arguments, yes.
Certainly, I think in the course of, it would also be clear to a FINRA panel who deals with securities issues all the time, in the course of the cross-examination of Mr. Renard, getting at these various points of soliciting investments that have been banned by FINRA and cross-examining him about lying on the forms that have to go through the process, which are critical for Ameriprise to be in compliance with their obligations under the self-regulation. But one more point on the questioning of Mr. Norman as well, which doesn't come across as clear in the briefs as maybe it should have, is that the panel clearly seized on this, and after Mr. Renard's attempts to rehabilitate the expert, for four or five pages of the transcript, the chair of the panel is asking in a dialogue with Mr. Norman about, well, how does this work where, you know, I think the panel chair refers to, you know, an analogy of, you know, in a different situation, what if the person killed somebody but hasn't been adjudicated? Do you mean to tell me that Ameriprise, in the analogous situation of Mr. Renard violating these various rules and regulations, do you mean to tell me that they have to keep him on? They can't terminate him immediately, even though they're exposing themselves to concurrent liability? So I think looking at the record as a whole, it quite clearly was involved in the 3 days of hearings prior to the closing arguments, and certainly by that time it was crystal clear. It's at that point that arbitration counsel discussed the Moody case, discussed the Bantam case, and then, of course, opposing counsel had time for rebuttal and did rebut those arguments, or attempted to rebut those arguments, in essentially the same fashion that they addressed those arguments today.
So can you tell me a little bit more about this document that lists five reasons for terminating him, why securities, you know, believed to be securities law violations doesn't appear in that list?
Sure. The first point there is that document is actually not in the record. It was referred to by Ameriprise's counsel in its closing argument. And essentially giving, you know, position, he discussed it there, essentially saying, you know, he's lucky in a way that we didn't check the box for 7E on this U-5. The U-5 is the form that firms like Ameriprise have to submit when an advisor leaves their firm or is terminated. So it really, in our view, doesn't have any relevance here. And if it were to be in the record, Ameriprise did check the box of yes to 7F, which says, was the person terminated or did he resign based on allegations of violations of laws or regulation or policy? So that's, in our view, is really a non-issue in this case. So I think, again, getting back to the process, there's nothing in this process to indicate that the arbitration panel took leave of their senses in reaching this decision that Ameriprise's position as a organization that has to have these compliance processes in place, and the purpose of those processes is to safeguard their customers and to be in compliance with the federal laws and regulations, that the heart of that matter is to promote customer safety and promote investors and disclosure to investors.
That's not exactly a preemption argument, though. I mean, how closely was the issue framed in closing argument about preemption, that this guy was immediately terminated in violation of the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law's opportunity notice and opportunity to cure
sure.
provisions because Ameriprise would have been out of compliance with its federal securities law obligations or related regulatory obligations, and thus there's a preemption issue.
Right. It was, how closely was it framed?
I mean, the Moody case is a preemption case,
yeah.
So, that's a hook.
Right. I guess, one, it was certainly presented to the panel. The argument was made. And I think the Bantam case is highly analogous to the situation. In Bantam, you had an advisor, or actually a broker that worked on the exchange, who believed that she had been sexually harassed. And the comparable self-regulated organization, the exchange in that case, through its processes that are dictated by the federal rules and the FINRA rules and regulations, went through its investigation and reached a disciplinary decision that then the plaintiff challenged in court under the New York state law. That's very similar here in that we have Ameriprise that obtained a customer complaint, then found out about all these improper solicitations of the of these leveraged and inverse ETFs, did their investigation and concluded that their obligations under the law and with regards to their policy was, we need to terminate this person immediately. And in part that decision was made because the evidence that was in the arbitration that Mr. Renard was, one, circumventing the compliance processes in place. So he was mismarking the order tickets, which would make it hard, obviously, to detect the solicitations. He was using outside emails with customers, again, circumventing Ameriprise's compliance systems. And he was also sending unapproved research to Ameriprise's clients. So the conflict comes in, why do we need to terminate Mr. Renard right away? Is we can't even have him around because all this evidence of circumventing our policies and procedures.
Well, circumventing the company's policies and procedures, but preemption requires a conflict between the federal law and the state law.
Right.
And so what's the conflict?
The conflict is that federal law essentially requires Ameriprise to certify their compliance and the conflict with him circumventing the processes that they have in place is that that under those laws they can't continue to keep him on and expose their customers to additional liability, exposing themselves to additional liability under those laws.
I'm not hearing a citation to any law.
I think one, the combination of the two cases that arbitration counsel cited, Bantam and Moody.
What's the federal law that creates the conflict here?
Yeah, the federal law is the Securities Exchange Act of 1934.
So you're saying under either that law or regulations, they have not only the right but the duty to terminate immediately, and under the Wisconsin Fair Dealer Statute, they can't terminate immediately. Somehow they have to have this lengthy period of time for cure and notice.
Correct, and that's where the conflict comes in, and it's certainly... That's not an issue in our view.
What is it in the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 that prevents giving securities dealers an opportunity for a cure?
It's not an express preemption.
Right, it's not there. It might be in the FINRA regulations, and the SEC has used its power under Section 15 to approve the FINRA regs, but there isn't anything in the statute.
That's correct. It's not an express preemption argument in the nature of the Moody case, where the Petroleum Marketers Act did have an express preemption, but it's a conflict preemption instance where you have the rules and regulations and you have the clear purpose of Congress in the entire structure of the industry, where you have the...
What FINRA rules are inconsistent with the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law's requirements of notice and opportunity to cure?
It's the specific rule is not coming to me at the top of my head, but it's the general construct of the obligations.
FINRA doesn't have general constructs. Those rules are astoundingly precise.
Right.
Right? One either violates FINRA rule or not. There aren't any general constructs. So
right.
If you can't identify a FINRA rule, it seems to me there isn't any preemption argument.
In our view, Ameriprise, by keeping them on, would have violated the rules of that pertain...
All of the rules?
No,
any
the rules cited,
rule?
Cited in our brief that pertain to the protection of investors, essentially. That you could not...
So it's possible the arbitrators made a mistake when they thought there was preemption.
It's possible they made a mistake, but that's not the issue before the court.
Right. That at least is doable. You say the FINRA rules cited in your brief. The only FINRA rules cited in your brief are the FINRA arbitration rules. You don't cite any FINRA substantive rules in your brief. Not a one.
Sure. We do cite, in addition, of course, that Section 10B and Section 17A, and what...
Which have nothing to do with opportunity for cure.
No, but
securities
deal. But they do...
We are in the world of Sections 13 and 15 of the 1934 Act, and the SEC's power to approve the rules of self-regulatory organizations.
Right.
At least we can get the right sections of a statute.
And I think what the cases we cited that address this conflict preemption, they address that Congress has set up this entire structure and the purpose of which is the protection of investors. And what we have here is an issue of Section 10B and 17A, and if Ameriprise were to keep him on, even during the period of supervision, where it was already clear that he was circumventing the protections in place, that they would be in conflict with those provisions of the federal securities laws by keeping him on for the 90-day notice period. But again, that's not the issue here, and this court doesn't have to even reach that substantive issue. The testimony of Mr. Renard's expert is enough to support this arbitration panel's decision, particularly with respect to the wide latitude that arbitration decisions are provided under the Federal Arbitration Act. If there are no further questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Stipik.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Gerbers?
With regard to Mr. Renard's expert, Mr. Renard's expert specifically testified that he was unaware of any law that prohibited or prevented or did not require the notice requirements of Wisconsin's Fair Dealership Law, including federal law. The notice that this court had asked, I think the court had asked, was there a notice of termination? Did it reference violation of securities law? That is in the record. The court has it. It's cited to in our brief. It was never identified as a basis for termination. And as far as preemption, there is no law that we're aware of that provides for preemption. And the case here is a claim that, look, I've looked for, it took me all of 20 minutes, I found two cases directly on point. The Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law is absolutely preempted by federal securities law. That's what this court cannot permit to stand. It's more than the court just making a mistake. It's the court being misrepresented to, causing it to exceed its authority and not enforce those requirements of the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. That's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.